this Mike Robbins idea of authenticity is highly parallel to Nicholas Taleb's idea of anti-fragility.
Uh-huh.
Because they both talk about a spectrum. Uh-huh. You know, on the left of Taleb's spectrum is fragile systems.
Right.
On the middle of Taleb's spectrum is resilient systems, which is like honesty. Like, wow, resilience is not good enough. So if you apply pressure to the system and if it goes back to the original state, that's not good enough. Just like honesty is not good enough. So, and both of them apply very similar principles of shock or vulnerability to make it better.
Fascinating.
It's just amazingly fascinating. And this is my epiphany moment that, wow, there are two seemingly disparate things that have the exact same parallels, you know, in terms of the continuum and so on.
Welcome to the 19th conversation of the Play to Potential podcast series. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, the creator and curator of these conversations. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders and help them be thoughtful about two questions that they often ask as they navigate life: where to go and how to grow. I'm excited to share that this podcast was recently awarded for innovation in digital publishing by DigiPub World. So thank you for all the support over these months. My guest this time is Dheeraj Pandey, co-founder, chairman, and CEO of Nutanix Inc., a $3.5 billion cloud computing company that had a successful IPO last year. Going back to one of my earlier podcast conversations with my guest Nandan Nilekani, one of the things he said was about India having a lot of startups, but fewer scale-ups. So in that context, I was really curious to talk about the scale-up bit with Dheeraj when he visited Mumbai recently on how he scaled up the company and his leadership capability as Nutanix has grown to what it is today. Without further ado, over to the conversation.
Dheeraj, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Pleasure.
And welcome to India.
Thank you.
If I may rewind the clock, Dheeraj. It's been a long journey, and it's great to hear all the good stuff about Nutanix. But if I take you back in time, I'm curious about the early formative years of people. And if I said, what are the two, three things that got baked in you in your formative years, let's say till you went to college, that still form a core part of who you are and that have helped you on the journey, what would you say?
You know, there was a part of me that was a little bit stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably use the word resolute.
Mm-hmm.
When I was four, my elder cousins used to call me Atal.
Mm-hmm.
And Atal is resolute. For probably some reasons that only they would be aware of, you know. But I think there was a level of resoluteness that actually helped me in later life as well.
Mm-hmm.
A big part of my psyche is probably a combination of both my mom and my dad. And this is not a cliche. It's like when I analyze myself, I'm like, what do I really learn from my parents? One of them, which is my mom's resoluteness, is, you know, is deep. I mean, I've seen her go through the adversities of life and what does it mean to really have us go through in English medium school and stay in Patna in a part of the world that was highly corrupt and the government was dysfunctional and my father was a government employee and it was lots of things that they actually had to sacrifice to even have us stay in Patna and go to a good English medium sort of schools. I think there was this resoluteness in her. We lost a lot. I mean, she lost probably everything to actually have her, have us get educated, you know, my brother and I and so on. I think my father had this thing about humility, which was very unique about him. So my mother's fierce resolve and my father's humility is this amazing combination that I've tried to practice throughout life. So when I was coming out of my high school, I was one of those people that said, look, it's not like I have to go to IITs, but, you know, at least I should have an option, have an optionality, like when we'll figure it out at the forks in the road and so on. And I was getting better and better at math and probably equally good at chemistry And so basically natural sciences in general, I was getting better and better at. So I started to realize that, look, maybe that's a path that I could take. Even though in the early years, I'm like, maybe I'm not even connected to engineering, you know. But the thing that made me sort of choose things in life were always based on this thing that said, the worst is not bad enough, go take that step. If the worst is not bad enough.
Interesting.
So you always thought about the worst case, and if the worst was not bad enough, the risk was worth it. That's the way I took to my early years. So, you know, I went to IIT in 1992, but I had a rank of 1420, and I realized that to get a brand change would probably be a lesser probability than if I were to quit and go back and take JEE one more time and get CS. The probabilities were higher that way. And most people
around me... And you monitored the probabilities from the inside or from the outside?
From the inside. I mean, okay. I was there for 2 months.
Got it. So you got a sense of what it took.
Okay. Yeah. I was there till October, and most people were like, what are you doing? You know, you have a great thing going here. And by the way, at worst case, you'll get double E, and that's good enough and so on. And I said, I just haven't tried, you know, hard enough. Let me just give it a try because the probabilities are way better there. And I knew that worst case, I'll just do physics, you know. I mean, maybe do St. Stephen's and do physics or something, you know. And there'll still be a path from there or something. If the worst is not bad enough, then I'll just take that. So I think I've used that throughout life, actually. The worst is not bad enough, then just go do it.
Very interesting. And just going back to your childhood, clearly you come from a humble background. I can relate to that. But again, cut to the present. I'm curious about, you know, given where you are, and let's say if you reflect on your kids growing up, how do you think about instilling some of these traits in them, given that they grow up in a very different environment in terms of comfort and in terms of what's taken care of? How do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, there's a sense of nostalgia about how we grew up. And I do know that anything that we have today is ephemeral. And it can vanish. So there's a sense of paranoia as well about some of that. And I teach them about, you know, we have three children. You know, my wife and I have three children. The eldest is 7. And we have twin girls who are 3.5. And there's simple things that we teach them. And I teach them about always about three things, and because there's something about three that is powerful.
As a McKinsey consultant, I can relate to that.
So like a couple of those trilogies that I teach them. One is, don't waste food, don't waste water, don't waste energy. So they're like, all of a sudden they understand, oh, what is energy? I'm like, this is energy. You switch the light off before you leave the room and so on. The other one is focus, listen, respect. So, you know, when I drop my son to school, I just say three and he knows what those three things mean and so on. So I think it helps to actually have that sense of paranoia that, look, these things actually do matter.
But just going, picking up on the, moving on to, let's say, computer science after having a lower rank the previous year. Moving forward, I want to sort of go to the point of graduation. And the interesting coincidence is I graduated in 97 as well from IIT Madras. And I had the option of joining UT Austin for a fellowship. But then I had admitted into IIM Ahmedabad, and clearly it was very disparate options, very orthogonal in a lot of ways, and decided to go stay back in India. But how did you think about that fork in the road when you had to pick between a job in India, a job at Deloitte, I understand, and a PhD at UT Austin? What was the processing framework at that stage?
Well, this is more like looking at process and substance. You know, I talk about this in negotiation. This is the way I think about things in life. So I was negotiating with my career in some sense, and a PhD was a process. The Deloitte and the Unilever job were like substance. You know, you could actually say that, look, I know exactly what I'm going to make, and therefore should I choose this and figure out things every 3-4 years, or should I pick a process that's robust? And that robust process is a PhD, and I like computer science. I developed a really good sense for math as well at IIT, you know, like set theory, inbuilt algebra, graph theory, linear algebra, you know, operations research. There's a lot of those things that I also did along with computer science. So I knew that UT would be a good place for that too, actually, if I were to really get into quasi-math, quasi-computer science too. And in some sense, I just knew that to build a good foundation. And because it was a fellowship, I thought that it would give me optionality to go and pick what I wanted in the next 18 months rather than having to pick something right away.
Got it. Very interesting. And just moving forward again, processing another fork in the road, you subsequently quit your PhD and went to the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So what were the, how did you process the trade-offs at that point in time?
Mm-hmm. So I had interned in the summer of 98 at Oracle.
Right.
In the summer of 98, if you remember, was probably the height of the bubble, the internet right. bubble. And this was in Redwood Shores, California. So right in the heart of the Silicon Valley, where everything was booming like it had never before. I mean, we had found the internet in 1994, 95. There was obviously the era of Netscape and the browser wars and you know, things like that. And it just looked like it was a different world altogether. It was probably as good as it was when we probably found oil or a steam engine or something of that nature, actually. It was that disruptive.
The Gutenberg kind of effort.
Exactly, effort. Exactly. So I think it was heady. I mean, those days were heady, and I was there for 3 months, and I'm like, you know what? Timing is everything. So why don't I actually take a leave of absence once I go back? So I finished my master's requirements, and I said I'll come back because right now it's also important to really deal with the industry and learn from the industry as well. So I did that for a couple of years when I was still in leave of absence, but finally it resulted in me having to resign or whatever the university said, look, you can't keep doing this forever. So you have to reapply if you really wanted a PhD. So in the year 2000, I literally drove from Texas to California, actually. And for before that, at Trilogy Software, which was the place that was my first job coming out of the master's. It was a great place to learn what it means to think about culture and also the fine line between culture and cult, you know, because sometimes the bubble becomes so resonant that all you can think of is the company and as opposed to what's happening outside.
Where do you draw the line? It's an interesting distinction. How do you think about the distinction between cult and culture?
I think cult is very inward focused, actually. Mm. Culture is like, you know, how do you actually survive and thrive in the presence of a context, surroundings and ambiance and environment. And Trilogy was missing that environment because it was going and spinning out all these companies like Car Order, Appliance Order, College Hire, PC Order, companies like that. But, you know, the groundedness was missing. There's a lot of wastage, not enough providence about what does it mean to really build a business and have books that you're willing to be proud of and go public and stuff like that. The company never went public, actually, even though they could have if they really were more provident about the future. So I worked there for a year and a half, and then I moved to the Bay Area, which is where I started really building more distributed systems, you know, closer to computer science that I had actually learned for like 6 years.
Got it. Moving forward, Dheeraj, I want to sort of talk about the journey at Nutanix. You started Nutanix with two co-founders.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pieces I'm curious about is how founders should think about co-founders,
mm-hmm.
both from a selection standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about picking the right co-founders?
Mm-hmm.
Right, I guess, is a strong word, but appropriate co-founders. And also, mm-hmm. what does it take to make the relationship work?
Mm-hmm.
If you could reflect a bit on what are the pulls and pressures that come on that relationship over time, mm-hmm. and what's been your lesson from that journey?
Yeah, I think the obviously there is a relationship between the founders, but also there's a relationship between the founders and the company.
Right.
And how the company is paramount.
Mm.
Because the company is now consistent of not just the founders and their entitlement, but also the new people who are joining.
Right.
Because the new people who've joined are now the company as much as the founders themselves are.
Sure.
So it's a relatively profound sort of, I would say, combination of relationships, which is like between the founders and the company.
Mm.
And I think to balance all of that is a very complex sort of system.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I've learned, and I learned this relatively early, that nobody is above the company.
Mm.
And the more you think like that, the more vulnerable you are the more the company gives back to you. You know, it's like a, that's how authentic relationships are, you know. You don't just keep thinking about taking from the company because you founded it. Very much like parents and children, and you know, at some point, you have to know that they have a life of their own as well, and they'll have their own careers and decision-making process and things like that. But eventually, it's the family, you know, that you really care for, as opposed to saying, you know, I am your father and I'm your mother, therefore it should be this way and so on. So I think,
and just maybe just to understand behaviorally, what does it mean in terms of do's and don'ts? What do you have in mind when you say entitlement as a founder? Just talk to us a little bit about.
Yeah, I mean, to say that you believe in yourself is great. I think there's this irrational confidence that you need and self-assuredness that you need, because obviously the world is saying don't do it. So founders need to be having that irrational confidence. But at the same time, you now need to also understand what does it mean to do this in the best interest of the company, where you are secure, where you give and you get back. And I think being authentic, where you're honest and you are reducing the level of self-righteousness that you need to have, because there's a level of self-righteousness you need to even start a company.
Correct.
But then as you have this thing becoming more and more real, and as the dust is settling and the company is becoming less nebulous and the market is being explored, you need to reduce the self-righteousness. Because now the negotiation is beginning with your early employees and with your early customers and so on.
Right.
So you need to now work in the context of people who are willing to give you a chance. You know, the early employees want to give you a chance. The early customers want to give you a chance. So you need to reduce and lessen that amount of self-righteousness and add a little bit of vulnerability. Where you're willing to say, look, I think I could be wrong, and let me go and learn from my early employees, and let me go and learn from my early customers. And that's the kind of give and take that you need to start out with, where people want to say, look, I want to actually deal with this set of founders, if it's early employees. I want to deal with this company, if you're an early customer and so on. So there's a lot of people dynamics and the psychological piece that's equally important here than just the idea itself.
Of course.
The idea, everybody has ideas. The question is, how do you really go and land it? And landing it would mean doing business, which is the most important thing about doing business is dealing with people.
Sure. And just maybe persisting with it, Dheeraj, I remember asking this question to Nandan Nilekani in the context of co-founding Infosys with several others. And when I asked him the question about how do you think about co-founders, he said three things, right? Trust, complementarity of skill set, and similarity of timelines in terms of postponement of gratification. So that you're solving for a similar time horizon. You're willing to make similar sacrifices over a period of time. So in your journey, if you had to whittle down to, let's say, maybe three, four questions entrepreneurs should ask themselves, just the smell test of could this person be a co-founder, what are the other themes that come up?
Well, the first one to me is constantly evolving, because the company is supposed to evolve.
Correct.
As it starts from this core idea to a business, to a competitive landscape, to a constantly changing landscape. You know, if the company needs to be that being that has to evolve, how can it do that without the core evolving all the time?
Right.
So the most important thing to me is a constantly evolving core. You know, every founder out there says, I can actually outpace the company's evolution. Because then I'm pulling the company forward rather than being pushed by the company.
Right.
You know, if you're lagging behind, you'll have to be pushed by the company or something.
Right.
So that is at the core of it. Now, the second one is, how do you deal with shocks? You know, can you learn from shocks? And can you be better with shocks in the system? You know, can you learn from mistakes and so on, which is again going back to constantly evolving sort of individual. And of course, the other one, which you can't early on figure out, because a lot of these things are tested over time, is being authentic. And authentic is an easy word to say, but it's really difficult to practice. You know, I mean, one of my best mentors is this person by the name of Mike Robbins, the TED speaker, talks about authenticity, has written books on it. And he said it's a formula. You know, it's really a spectrum that goes from dishonest people on the left to honest people in the middle, which basically says it's not good enough to be honest. So you got to take something out of honesty and add something to honesty to make it authentic. Mm-hmm. What you take out is self-righteousness, and what you add is vulnerability. And honesty minus self-righteousness plus vulnerability is authentic. You know? So, I mean, I go by four A's myself, you know, when I look at a business, when I look at people, and I'm trying to practice myself to become a better professional and a leader. Obviously, one of them is anti-fragility, like how do you learn from shocks and get better? Authenticity. And there's ambition and attention to detail. So there are four different A's. Ambition, attention to detail, which go hand in hand.
Very interesting. And
ambition is the optimism, attention to detail is the paranoia. And together they have to be, because they are the left brain, right brain, the schizophrenic sort of mindset that you need to have as founders.
Got it.
Because you need to be a visionary, but at the same time, you need to know how to land the vision. And landing it is about the attention to detail.
Very interesting. Just going back to your leadership style, you spoke about growing, pulling the company forward than being the bottleneck, right, as one of the prerequisites. And just as the organization evolves, let's say from being hustlers to builders to scalers, how has your leadership style evolved? How have you evolved as a person if you reflect on the Dheeraj of 2008 September when you started Nutanix?
2009
September when you started Nutanix. And now, 8 years later, how have you grown? And where have you grown?
One thing that I've observed with myself is that I learn more from life than ever before. You know, I've really come to internalize that business and life are not two different things. Technology and business are not two different things. And, you know, they're all interweaved together, actually. You know? So I've come to really value context. And when I say context, I mean that at the end of the day, technology is not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. Business is not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. Eventually, they all have to draw parallels from everything else that we see around us in life. So I'm doing more and more of that. So whenever there's a tough decision to be made, I'm looking at what else is out there that looks like this. It doesn't have to be from the industry. It can be from something completely different, and it helps. You know, this just this idea of focus, listen, respect that I talked to my son about. You know, I'm trying to figure out, are we doing that enough with our customers? You know, are we doing that enough with our employees and so on? You know, so we have this customer-centric attitude because employees are also customers in some sense and so on. You know, I think I've evolved a lot in this area of really connecting the dots between life and business and technology, actually. I've also evolved to be more uncomfortable, which means feeling more vulnerable than before in tough decisions, actually, when it comes to tough decision-making. Because early on, I mean, if you're a people guy and you were gregarious and so on, you like being liked. And then you got to realize that your decisions have to go to protect the company as much. And because the company is a bunch of people as opposed to just the individual. So there's individual relationships you have and then a relationship you have with the company.
Right.
And if you do a good job of it, then all of a sudden you'll get comfortable about the realization that you might not be liked, but you are better off being respected. So how do you start to get comfortable with this idea that you'd rather like being respected than being liked? And a very sort of fine line between the two, actually. You know.
And from a behavior standpoint, what's the trade-off there? What do you need to start doing differently to move the needle from being liked to sort of being respected?
A lot of it is about decision-making. A lot of it is about seeing 2 to 3 years ahead. A lot of it is about optimizing for the whole versus the individual. Including myself, like, you know, am I, because that's what keeps me vulnerable as well. It's not like I'm the guy without which the company won't run, actually. I have to think about things like succession planning as if it's a natural state of being as opposed to something that's uncomfortable. I have to think about the company as if it's a living being, you know, and think about its goodness. And I think these are things that you never thought about, because when you started out, it was about your brilliance and your ideas and your sort of endurance and things like that. And eventually it's like, well, I'm just helping a living being, because there's thousands of families that now depend on this thing.
Right.
I mean, there's 3,000 plus families that depend on Nutanix today.
Right.
So you got to know what the burden of responsibility means. You know? And obviously I've become a lot more long-term greedy than ever before. Every year I'm becoming more about the long-term than before, actually. And again, it ties back to thinking about the company. You know, what does it mean to be long-term greedy than being short-term greedy and have, you know, this instant gratification sort of...
And just to maybe give us an example of the decisions you take to sort of to move the organization in that direction of being long-term
greedy. Yeah, I mean, obviously lots of companies want to optimize the current quarter.
Right.
And because they believe that the stock will go up if they actually did a great job with the current quarter. But many a time, the short-term and the long-term are at odds with each other. You know, as a public company, yes, we need to do sprints, you know, quarterly sprints. But you need to constantly keep in mind that, look, this company is a marathon of sprints.
Mm.
So yes, Wall Street cares about the sprints, but eventually... the stakeholders in the company, who are long-term shareholders and employees and customers, they care for the marathon, because they are investing for the marathon. In companies, customers of Nutanix are not just buying the thing today; they're buying an experience for the next 5 years. You know, employees are not just, you know, employed here for the next 6 months; they are investing in an experience for the next 5 years. You know? Hopefully, company defining and, you know, generational wealth building and so on. And these are not short-term decisions that they've taken.
Right.
You know, because what we've done is we're trying to re-architect computing.
Right.
So it already is highly disruptive.
Right.
Just the definition re-architecture
right.
is highly disruptive. So the customers who are actually embracing us are folks who are saying, I want to look at the next 3 to 5 years with you, because I don't re-architect every year.
Got it.
So I think that long-term greed is more pervasive in me than ever before.
And just going back to the question, Dheeraj, just from a leadership style perspective, whether it's in terms of how you spend time or in terms of how you connect with this living being, what's the signature shift from each of these phases, hustling to building to scaling, if you had to really bring it down to one, two, or three? Are there distinctive shifts that you've made in the way you engage with the living being?
Mm-hmm. So the first thing is that the companies, in the company's arcs of life, you know,
right.
there's a great presentation that Mark Leslie actually made a few years ago at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of my mentors, actually. He's a founder and ex-CEO of Veritas software. He was on our board for 4 years. And he basically talked about how you need to keep launching new arcs of a company for it to be relevant, because
right.
you know, the cycle of creative destruction, which is compressing every
right.
5 years, you know, it's compressing even further. I think you are building and you're scaling and you're maintaining all at the same time, maybe three different products.
Mm.
You know, maybe there are three different companies within a larger company or something.
Mm.
Because obviously, if you're not building 5 years hence, then your current product will be destroyed or destructed because of the competitive landscape around you.
Right.
And I think in that sense, you know, the fact that we're a multi-product portfolio company now, we have to go and wash, rinse, repeat what we built 8 years ago and 6 years ago. But we're also constantly building and scaling maybe two other products. You know, like we built an operating system, which is the hypervisor, 4 years ago, and we're scaling it, and then we are building new things on top of all that. So this is now a multi-layered cake. And the base of the cake is things is something that you're maintaining, but the, you know, the top layers of the cake are things that you're actually building.
Got it. And again, it sort of goes back to the solving for the quarter and solving for the long-term.
Exactly.
As you
exactly.
said.
Yeah.
And just going back to the anti-fragility piece that you mentioned, I'm curious about the term. I'm a big fan of Nassim Nicholas Taleb as well and his work. Talk to us about some of the near-death experiences of Nutanix. And more specifically, what do you mean in terms of anti-fragility, in terms of both building that mechanism at an individual level, but also how do you think about how do you inject anti-fragility into the culture of an organization?
You know, one thing, again, going back to drawing parallels, you know, I really believe the more things change, the more they remain the same. So this Mike Robbins idea of authenticity is highly parallel to Nicholas Taleb's idea of anti-fragility. Because they both talk about a spectrum. You know, on the left of Taleb's spectrum is fragile systems.
Right.
On the middle of Taleb's spectrum is resilient systems, which is like honesty. Like, wow, resilience is not good enough. So if you apply pressure to the system and if it goes back to the original state, that's not good enough. Just like honesty is not good enough. So, and both of them apply very similar principles of shock or vulnerability to make it better.
Fascinating.
It's just amazingly fascinating. And this is my epiphany moment that, wow, there are two seemingly disparate things that have the exact same parallels, you know, in terms of the continuum and so on. So anti-fragility and the shocks that Taleb attaches to those things is similar to honesty plus vulnerability. It makes you more authentic. Which is what, you know, anti-fragile is. So I think learning from shocks, being vulnerable, are things that are very, very closely tied to my psyche now.
What does being vulnerable mean from a leadership standpoint? What sort of behaviors would you break it down to?
Well, in everything that we do as a business, as engineers, as architects, as product managers, we need to have caveats. Like when we write a design doc, we need to have something that says, and these are the things that we've not considered. And by the way, these are the things that it does not address.
Right.
In a product requirements document, we talk about trade-offs, you know, about what kind of things it does. And all of a sudden, it's more authentic. When you actually talk about the fact that we've not considered these things, you are reducing friction. When you do press releases, you don't talk about industry leader. I hate the word industry leader, self-proclaimed monikers like industry leaders. I'm like, look, we're just trying to be something and we've not achieved that thing, you know. And along the way, we should talk about how we could still fail, you know. And when you say that, all of a sudden, the audience lowers the guard and says, you know what, this is believable because it's human to be vulnerable, actually. You do the same thing in board meetings, you know. How do you actually go there and not try to be this superhuman with a mantle of perfection around you that, you know, is highly impregnable business professional that is basically running a perfect show and so on. Instead, if you look at your board members as human beings and as people you can learn from and they're willing to help you with some of those things, all of a sudden is a much better board environment than if you had to look at them as people who are overseeing you or something.
Got it. And on culture, how do you think about injecting anti-fragility into your culture at Nutanix? How have you gone about doing that?
I mean, if you think about B2B, and again, similar to B2C as well, customer success is everything. And technologies are never perfect. Products are never perfect. So I look around and see, look at what really is common about the best brands in the world. It's customer service. You know, you look at the best brands in the world, they could be in completely disparate industries, but the one thing they have in common is loyalty from the customer, which comes because of customer service. It's the human-to-human thing that actually connects businesses to people or consumers, actually, you know. And I was listening to Deepak Chopra 3 years ago, and he said, look, the richest people in the world, they don't buy things. They buy experiences, right? So how do you deliver that experience during the lows? Obviously, technologies fail. So if you go and make it memorable, you know, this idea that you're apologetic and you're vulnerable, and yet you will improve the situation, that's what people remember. They don't remember the fact that your product failed. What they remember is how you came together to really make it better and make their overall experience way better as well. And these are the war stories that humans want to remember. You know, same thing with software. I mean, we talk about self-healing. It's at the core of machine learning and AI is that man does less and machine does more. So what does it mean for machine to do more? Machine learns from another machine about its inherent vulnerabilities, and it tries to improve by recovering on its own and stuff like that. You know, like we run software on commodity hardware. The word commodity is highly vulnerable because, you know, commodity hardware fails a lot. So how does software recover from that? And in this state of being that says, look, it's okay for hardware to fail, I'll go and make it better. I'll be able to, before I alert the human, I know exactly what it means for the software to recover and self-heal and so on. I think they are all very important parts of a design of the next generation systems where a man does less and less, and the man-machine interface is not crossed as often as we used to in the past. You know, humans do as little as possible, and machines can do more because machines are anti-fragile.
Very interesting. That's an interesting parallel to machines and anti-fragility. And in this context, Dheeraj, if I may sort of ask a different question, given your journey thus far and given your window into the future, given artificial intelligence and machine learning and what it takes to thrive in the future, how should people think about education and careers, right? For the engineer that's coming out of an IIT or another engineering college, somebody coming out of another college, if you were to sort of distill that back to the point of choice, whether it's educational choice or career choice, how would you think about that?
You know, I'll connect it back to life and computer science, you know, both together. Because when I say computer science, I mean software more than anything else.
Sure.
But obviously, machine is doing everything now, or it's increasingly doing a lot now. And I look at this trifecta between man and machine. If you look at, there's three relationships, you know, between these two things. There's a man-to-man relationship. And when I say man, I don't mean to be...
human beings. You
know, I just mean human to human.
There's no gender.
So there's the man-to-man relationship, there's a man-to-machine relationship, and the machine-to-machine relationship, right? So coming out of college, if I were to come out of college right now, I would say, do I understand the three things really well? The man-machine interface is about design. Like, it's all about reducing friction at the boundary of man and machine. It's about user experience, it's about user interface, it's about, you know, there's a very popular principle called Maya principle that says most advanced yet acceptable. Like, Google Glasses was not following Maya, and therefore it failed because society didn't accept somebody actually wearing glasses that could record a conversation without you knowing about it. So man-machine interface is really important for anybody to start a business. Machine-machine is about APIs. You know, how do components of software talk to other components at arm's length with advertised APIs, SLAs, and interfaces that are well understood. Really important for people to know, what do you even mean by APIs, actually? Well, it's machine talking to machine. You know, and you need to have clear separation of concerns and responsibilities and advertised SLAs and responsibilities. And the last one is, you know, human beings and human beings, you know. It's like, so in all these three, you have to reduce friction. It's at the core of a career is reducing friction. If you can say, am I really good at reducing friction in these between these three interfaces? I think you'll be one of the most amazing professionals that the industry has actually seen. You constantly think about the man-machine interface. How do I reduce friction? How do I make sure that we have designed it the best with one-click paradigms and thinking about the consumer as opposed to you know, thinking about a power user and so on. Machine-machine interface, how do you reduce friction between two components of software? And then man-man interface, am I good enough to deal with people and conflicts, and what does it mean for me to have authentic relationships and things like that? I think it's an easy way to remember if you are conducting yourself well every day, and are you constantly evolving in the world of design, in the world of APIs, and in the world of, you know, people actually respecting you for who you are.
Very interesting. But again, if I may persist and bring it back to the notion of choice, arts, science, engineering, design, you know, law, I guess it's a commerce. It's a bewildering set of options. So do you have a sort of a, some sort of a view on how one should think about diversity of choice?
It's a very, very, very coincidental and timely question you asked. There was a Wall Street Journal article that came last week about Leonardo da Vinci. And he basically, and the whole thing about him was that he didn't box himself into any one thing. And the best companies in the world, the best people in the world are nondescript.
It's hard to put a label to them.
Yeah, you can't put them in a class. Like when Steve Jobs, you'd come and talk about, look, who is Apple? Apple is at the boundary of arts and technology. Right? That's what makes Apple, Apple. And that's what makes a professional special. That they're learning about everything. They learn about arts, they learn about science, they learn about computer science, they learn about design, they learn about humans, and they bring it all together into what business should be and so on. I think that those are the most successful people in the world and the most successful businesses in the world. I mean, think of Amazon. This is selling books, right? To selling everything in the world to now selling computing. They did not box themselves into saying that, hey, we are only a book-selling company and our only goal is to go and disrupt Barnes & Noble, right? I think all they cared for, the operating system had two or three levers, convenience and ubiquity and simplicity. They said, look, if we can actually make these things work across anything, I think, and price, obviously, you know, I think they said we can make this work across any walk of life, we become a giant company, actually.
Got it.
So I would actually, you know, say that the, if people coming out of college, they should not try to box themselves and learn from different walks of life and bring it all together into one.
Very interesting. The other piece I wanted to talk about, Dheeraj, was the notion of bringing a leader from the outside, a CEO from the outside. Again, as the organization scales up, at some stage, founders, co-founders need to be honest with themselves on the should I lead versus should I get somebody else to lead. How have you thought about that decision as the company has grown and evolved over time?
And as going back to what I said about constant evolution, that if I as a business professional, as an individual, if I'm not evolving faster than the company, then the company is slowing down because of me.
And how do you build an objective view of that?
I think people around you will tell you. And obviously there's KPIs and objectives and key results that actually will show. But I think a lot of it will come from people around you as well. And leaving on a high has its own merits and, you know, sort of there's something special about it as opposed to leaving when things are actually going down. And knowing that, you know, when you talked about succession planning and things like that, those are so important. I mean, you talk about fault tolerance of the system. I think when you deal with building software, you're always thinking about fault tolerance. It's so important to think about fault tolerance even in this world of business as well. I mean, and many businesses have not done a good job of baton passing. And if you look at venture capital firms in the US, many of them shriveled after the first generation or the most successful generation actually tried to pass the baton because they held it for too long. It has happened in companies. Look at companies out there in the last 30 years in IT itself that just kept the baton with themselves for too long. And it is, by the way, it's actually not that easy to make those calls, but you need to think about it every day. Like, how are you actually protecting the company? What kind of people are you bringing in? I mean, one of the problems with succession planning is that potential successors don't have patience. You know, they're like, look, I'm getting another job outside, especially in the Valley.
Right.
So it is not an easy problem to solve.
Mm.
But again, I draw parallels from the things that I've seen were not baton passed well.
Mm.
And I'm keeping it in the back of my mind right now. That, look, I need to worry about these things because the company is paramount. And honestly, it actually serves my family well as well, because if something were to happen to me, at least I would leave something that is more robust behind than if I were to be selfish about just my own egos.
Mm. And just on the point about getting somebody in from the outside at a senior leadership level, and specifically focusing on the first 3 to 6 months, because that's often the make or break, what's been your experience on getting the transitions right? What do you do or what do you not do to ensure that people at very senior levels come in and flourish in a company like Nutanix?
Well, in the interview process, first of all, you hire slowly and you fire fast, as opposed to the other way where you hire fast and you fire slowly.
Mm.
I think it's the biggest contagion of any company when you hire fast and you fire slowly, actually.
Mm.
You should hire slowly, which means you need to understand the operating system of the individual, not just their resume and their numbers, because we talk about their past performance through numbers. You don't know how many people are involved in that, actually.
Mm. I love the term operating system. It sort of says the inner
wiring. Yeah, yeah. By the way, it's in everybody. In every business is an operating system. Every individual has an operating system. Every machine has an operating system, actually.
Yeah.
So I think you need to understand the operating system of individuals. And if you think that they're authentic people, they're ambitious, they have an attention to detail, they look like they're anti-fragile, they've learned from mistakes and so on, then you hire them. And then, in the first 6 months, you need to be as authentic with the whole sort of shift as well, because you need to be vulnerable. You need to know that your idea is not everything. You need some new ideas to be infused in there as well. And you trust. Obviously, you also verify eventually, because that's the attention to detail that you need. But you have to trust. And it's a process of negotiation. It's a process, the first 6 months. I mean, obviously, I've not gone through bringing in a CEO, but when we bring in new individuals as executives and so on, we have to actually be in this process of negotiation where you have to have empathy. You need to understand what is it that they are trying to do. Are they focusing on the substance or the process? And not the what, but the how. Like, you know the why, like why did you bring them in? And you look at the what, which is the ideas, but the question is, how is it that they're thinking about going and implementing these things? Got is it about mass change to the existing team, or are they actually willing to figure out the process behind knowing the team first? Do they want to understand the team, and there's a bell curve of people in the team, and how do you retain the best, and how do you coach the ones in the peak of the bell? And then you can get rid of the ones that are actually not being able to cut it, but there is a process behind that too, actually. So are the new leaders willing to go through that process itself?
Very interesting. And just to maybe stick with the metaphor of operating system, the culture of a company is also like an operating system. There's a way in which people work. How do you transfer that? Or transfer is a wrong term, but how do you sort of familiarize or sensitize a new leader to the operating system of the company? How do you go about doing that? Is there a certain method to the madness, or you?
Yeah, I mean, culture has to be constantly evolving as well, because the culture is a function of insiders and outsiders.
Sure.
And if you're saying you can bring in new insiders, then you're already dead. Right. And obviously, culture is a function of the competitive landscape, the macro environment in which you operate. The context matters, actually. So culture is not a constant. Ideally, it should be a few things that is the core strength of character of a company. And it could be things like, the 4A they talk about. Like, well, we're ambitious, and we have an attention to detail, and we're authentic, and we're anti-fragile, but everything else is up for grabs. Everything else is up for grabs, actually. Whatever is not covered, and it could be any 3 or 4 letters for any company, which are fundamental. You can't say, oh, we'll have a company that doesn't have ambition. We'll have a company that has huge ambition but no attention to detail. And so if you keep that constant, everything else should and can change and must change, because the world around you is constantly evolving and changing. So I think if new people come in and they have ideas that are equally ambitious, and you know that they'll operate with an attention of to detail, and the fact that they look like an authentic idea, and you know that you are not betting your farm. If there's shocks in the system, this idea can evolve and you can navigate through the changes based on the feedback from the market and so on. You know, it's, you have to give these new things a try.
It goes back to the point about worst not being bad enough. Right?
Exactly, yeah. If the worst is not bad enough, you'll navigate, actually.
Got it.
So, yeah, I think, you know, to me, the moment somebody says, oh, this is not what the culture of the company is, I'm like, in what way? Mm-hmm. Right? Are you talking about the core principles on which we operate, which is the character? Or are you talking about culture, which needs to constantly evolve?
Mm. And just moving topics, one of the things I heard you mention in a different conversation was about starting a family, and initially sort of thinking about focusing on entrepreneurship, but later realizing that becoming a father has made you a better entrepreneur. Talk to us a little bit about what's behind that.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, that as I evolve, I realize that I weave in life and business together.
Mm.
And it's not like there's two streams that don't mix.
Mm.
I have to weave them together. Learn from life, apply to business, learn from business, apply to life. Like the idea of waste and delight. You know, these are things that I initially learned in life, but we're applying it to the business. But I then take these ideas because I'm trying to remind everybody about waste. You know, at scale, you know, you really have to worry about waste as much as delighting your customers.
Sure.
And your employees. You have to worry about waste. And if you do a really good job of waste, that's delightful to Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Look, it's not delight at all costs. It's also figuring out waste. But then you take those ideas to your children, because you're constantly repeating the word waste. You take it back to children and say, waste. You know, so celebrate eliminating waste even at home, because now they'll be grounded if they think about, do not waste energy, do not waste water, do not waste food. I think they're learning to become better individuals just based on whatever I'm repeating every day at work, actually. So you try to just hop around the two experiences and just make them melt into one.
Very interesting. And just a couple of questions in summary, Dheeraj. How do you think about success, and how has that evolved over time? Given where you are today, what would success look like 5 years out, 10 years out? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think at this point, if you would ask me, obviously, this is also a constantly evolving definition of success. It is about building a ton more millionaires in the company and a lot of CEOs. If you can do that, and by the way, that's the hard part, actually. You know, it always, it only happens if you build a long-lasting operating system. You know, which is serving the needs of the machines at the side of customers, but it's also serving the individual who works for Nutanix, you know, because along the way they built their own operating system and they finessed and improved and operated the operating system of the business itself, actually. So if you can build a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of generational wealth for these employees that we actually have, I think that'd be success.
And just maybe a quick comment on, how do you think about leadership development in a hypercharged growing company, right? Clearly, the space you're in is sort of exploding. How do you think about the elements of leadership development, both at your level, but also in terms of building the next generation of leaders within Nutanix?
I think a lot of it is about saying that my fundamental tool set is 3, 4, 5 words. It can be 10 words or 20 words or whatever. So the fundamental tool set is 3 or 4 words. And I've tried to make them like 4 A's or 3 this or whatever, you know. The question is, how do you, when you're in the heat of the moment, how do you remind yourself of these 3, 4 words? Because you need a reminder. You need somebody to knock at the door and say, look, you need to go back to the basic principles of decision making, of leadership, of whatever it is. So breathing helps a lot. just learning to breathe helps you remember those four words. So at the core, and there's nothing more fundamental than breathing in life. So all of a sudden, those four words are back to one action, breathe. Even in the room, when you have a heated discussion going on, an animated discussion about strategy and arguments and this and that, what is the one thing, and obviously I'm not very good at it, but I'm trying to get better every day, breathe. And there is physiological reasons attached to this, by the way. Because the more oxygen goes into your brain, the more you're actually thinking better. And there's all sorts of synapses and, you know, electrical signals that are passing through for you to be more intelligent, more patient, you know, more authentic in your thinking and so on. So at the core of leadership development, if you would ask me one word, it's breathing.
Wow. That's a different dimension of insight. Very interesting. In conclusion, Dheeraj, just like businesses grapple with the two questions, where to play, how to win, as they grow and as they make strategic decisions, I believe leaders ask the two questions along the way, where to go and how to grow. What's your take on these two questions in the context of people playing to their unique potential?
Obviously businesses need to know what they are really good at. And ideally, they should be good at both things, you know, actually all three of these, you know, they should be really good at the man-machine boundary, you know, which is convenience, simplicity, how do consumers deal with your product, you know, how simple it is to use and how forgiving it is and is it dump-proof and so on. So you have to be really good at that. Obviously, you have to be good at, you know, how do I really scale my operating system if I didn't have componentized view of it and if I didn't have APIs and things like that? What are the SLAs between departments and between two pizza teams? And how do you break down your big business into smaller stuff that's more manageable? And finally, you know, do you have a culture where people are not constantly fighting, right, which is the man-man or human-to-human relationship and so on? I think at the core, you need to know which ones of these are you good at. Because some, like Oracle, has great products, but you know the sales motion sucks. You know, when they go and talk to customers, you know, there's this very different kind of arrogance that people look at and say, I don't know. I mean, I like your products, but I don't like the way you interact with me, actually. So as long as you know what you're good at, and probably they can get a pass because it's so sticky a product. It's like there's not too many options. It's hard to move away from it and so on. They've built some amazing machine-to-machine APIs basically that make the whole thing damn hard to actually approve and so on. So you need to know what your strengths are and play it on your strengths, actually.
Lovely. Pleasure talking to you, Dheeraj. Thanks so much for making the time.
Pleasure. Mine. Thank you.
Hope you found the conversation purposeful. If I reflect on the conversation and say what were the big takeaways for me, I'd say three things struck me the most in this chat. One is about having a clear understanding of risk and reward at various points in time and playing with real options as we navigate various forks on the road. It was great to hear Dheeraj talk about his taking JE twice and how he went on a sabbatical and tested out the next opportunity. Just being careful but at the same time not being too risk-averse. The second was about self-awareness and clarity around what's unique to you, what drives you, and what is core to you. Dheeraj spoke about four A's which are dear to him. It's critical both from a development standpoint, but also from a shaping the core character of the company standpoint. The third was around the notion of interconnectedness across the various domains of life. I couldn't agree more about how one can look at different dimensions in harmony than in discrete buckets. Thank you for listening. If you find this content purposeful, do take a breather, as Dheeraj suggests, and leave a review on iTunes and share it with people that you think will benefit from this. And I really look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.